I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Christine Hallquist is the former CEO of Vermont Electric Cooperative. She ran the rural co-op for 12 years before stepping down earlier in 2018 to focus on her bid for governor. Hallquist is hoping to be the Democratic nominee. She goes up against three other candidates on the ballot in Vermont's August 14th primary, James Ehlers, Brenda Siegel, and Ethan Sonneborn. State Senator John Rogers is a write-in candidate, though he's leaving all his campaigning and fundraising up to his supporters. Hallquist is running with an eye toward current incumbent Phil Scott. She touts her record as an energy CEO and focuses on economic development in the state. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll ask her about her platform, why she wants the job, and where she stands on major issues facing the state. Christine Hallquist, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why do you want to be the governor?
Well, you know, look, I voted for Phil Scott, but I'm disappointed that he's adopted the policies of the National Republican Party. I'm a person that pulls people together to do big things. And up until March, I was the CEO of Vermont Electric Cooperative, as you accurately stated. My passion was to demonstrate the electric grid could solve climate change. When we left, we were 96% carbon free. We were offering incentives for people to move away from fossil fuel heating, cooling, and transportation. And we did it without a rate increase for 5 years, essentially proving you can solve climate change and it does not need to cost more money.
You say Phil Scott has sided with the National Party. On which specific issues? Because there are many Republicans who would say, actually, he has not, and that's a problem for them.
Well, he's focused. When I talk about the tactics, he's focused on the politics of division rather than solidarity and unity.
In what way?
Well, in certainly from what he's done to the legislature the past 2 years is really I certainly wouldn't call it leadership. And I'll talk specifically about education, for example. You know, barking orders from Montpelier, coming up with arbitrary metrics, and then beating up the teachers and school boards after they came in with a 1.5% increase, and he had set the goal at 2.5%. I mean, that's pulling the rug out from under people. And that's really upsetting.
You have been a CEO. You've been a business leader. How would you lead differently?
Well, I would also tell you that the use of the veto is a sign of failure. What you do is you empower people and you create a clear vision and you create alignment around that vision. You know, the nice thing about folks is 95% of people get up and want to do a good job. And if you really tap into the passion, you get tremendous results, miraculous results, which I've seen several times in my career. I'll tell you, an engaged employee produces about three times what a disengaged employee is. So as a leader, you can really change your culture, and the culture starts at the top. The leader owns the culture.
So when you talk about engaging people, helping them find their passion, are you thinking of the legislature or are you thinking of Vermonters in general?
I'm thinking of everybody. I will tell you that I believe the leader, the chief executive of the state owns the culture of the state. And that includes the school boards, the employees, the teachers and the legislature.
You mentioned education funding. So this has been a perennial problem in Montpelier, but not one that you've had to deal with in your work as an energy CEO, at least not, sort of right directly. So what would you do in terms of education funding and how it affects property taxes, how we get the right ratio, how we deal with schools and school consolidation? What's your approach?
Well, I will tell you that the property tax has been flawed, and you can go all the way back to the history of when it started after World War II. If you look at property taxes, and I'm going to use, after World War II, Levittown was formed. It was certainly a homogeneous white population. And the federal government actually redlined districts, and they greenlined districts for loans, low-interest loans. And if you think about what happened, and I'm going to get to how this impacts Vermont, what happened is in those redline areas, which were areas where the African-Americans live, or people of color, they couldn't get the loans. They couldn't get the low-interest loans. But in the green areas, people were able to purchase homes, and then businesses came in, and then employment came in. And the equity grew in those homes, and people were able to use that equity to put their kids to college. So, I use that as the extreme example of how education started funded. And that that creates the same problems in Vermont. I was actually on the Hyde Park School Board when we filed as part of Act 60 in the late 90s. You know, we were seeing the same thing, a microcosm. Although Vermont's very homogeneous, we still had those differences town to town.
Sure, and socioeconomic ones for sure.
Yes, as well.
Okay, but so would you blow up the whole system and start again?
Oh, no, no, no. You have to be very careful in terms of restructuring things like this. And you got to be careful when you label things broken, because we're not broken. We have the, and I'm going to point out to the fact that we're not doing too bad a job. We have the highest number of rural schools in our population of the states per capita, and we have the fifth highest education cost. And I will tell you that the cost and density go hand in hand. So it's not a blown-up system. I want to make that clear.
Can you give me specifics on what you would do? Because, I mean, this is one of the things that every single governor struggles with. And, you know, there are a lot of things that every single governor struggles with, including connectivity, including energy. But education is a perennial problem, and everybody says it needs to be fixed. And if you're sitting in that chair, what do you do to fix it?
Well, I'm a boots-on-the-ground type of leader. You should know that, you know, I met with every single employee. We had 107 employees once a year for them to give me my review. I'm boots on the ground because the employees will come up with a solution. Those teachers are committed to those students. And there are lots of suggestions that I've talked to with the teachers, including optimizing the schools by providing wraparound services, just mental health care, pediatric care, daycare services, and making investments in pre-K, for example, are things that we can get a great return on. And so I would turn to the communities and schools to come up with those solutions, because every town is different. You have one town where the other elementary school is 5 miles away. Meanwhile, you get down to southern Vermont, like Reading, Vermont, and you've got 20 miles away for the nearest school. So it's a town-by-town type solution. And I promise you, those folks will come up with much better solutions than the management can. Employees always come up with better solutions.
Would you say you are a strong supporter then of local control? Because this, again, has been one of the questions about, should there be a statewide solution to something like education? Can towns do it themselves? Can you have a statewide education property tax and yet still have towns deciding for themselves how to do this all? So do you have a, you know, do you sort of side with the local control folks, or are you more, you know, the state should be able to give some answers as well?
Well, I think it works both ways, but I do side with local control. And let me people have argued for a statewide teacher's contract. I promise you a statewide teacher's contract will cost you more than local contracts, because I've had a lot of experience with unions. And when I see strikes go on, they happen because of morale issues. And it's really bad leadership that results in those strikes. And it really is. Again, I go back to the way Phil Scott's handling it. That's what creates that morale issue. But the teachers, they know their community and they're committed to their community. Once you depersonalize it and you do it at the statewide level, it's going to cost you more money.
Are you supportive of unions, generally speaking?
Very supportive of unions. And I have a great story to tell about my first experience with the unions. I was leading a team that designed the Model Miller Brewery that was put in Trenton, Ohio. And there were two executives on the team. Before we even started the design, they brought the union in. I said, "Why did you bring the union in?" They said, "Because they come up with better answers." And when I took over as CEO of Vermont Electric Cooperative, the company was on the edge of bankruptcy. The state was ready to put it out of business, had the highest number of outages in the state and highest cost. I pulled the employees together and I said, "Look, I've got a lot of business experience, but I only give myself a 10% chance of turning this around. But if we all work together, we can turn it around. And oh, by the way, I did something else. I said, by the way, we're all going to abide by the benefits of the union contract, including me. Whatever raise you get, I get. By the way, today we have an A+ rating with Standard & Poor's. The outages have been cut by more than half. In 2010, the Department of Energy recognized us as the most innovative utility in the nation. And if you look at those results, especially the financial results, going from BBB- with a negative outlook to an A+ rating, people would tell you that's impossible. But it's not impossible when you pull together with folks.
Let's go to Shauna, who's calling in from Guildhall. Hi, Shauna. You're on the air.
Hello, Jane. Hello, Christine. Thank you for taking my call. My partner and I were able to move to rural Vermont, where there are very few job opportunities because our town actually has DSL internet, which supports my home business. These rural areas need economic stimulation if we want them to thrive. Christine. I want to know what your plans are for rural economic development, both for those who already live here in rural Vermont and those who are looking to move here.
Thanks for the call, Shauna.
I'll take my answer off.
Yeah, thank you, Shauna. A key part of my platform is rural economic development because of everybody benefits if rural Vermont grows. And a key part of that is connecting every home and business with fiber optic cable so that rural Vermonters can be connected to the internet at the same speed as New York and Tokyo. And also, coupled with that, is building the downtown development plans so that when people do locate their businesses in rural Vermont, they can have places to go. And a good friend of mine, Liz Gamash, was the mayor of St. Albans, and I think the gold standard of what you can do for communities is up in St. Albans. And that was done through tax increment financing districts. And it was key that heavy involvement for the governor was involved with that. And, of course, Springfield has just started to do that as well as Brattleboro. So I would repeat that throughout the entire state. And I will tell you that I spent 10 years on the Technical Advisory Committee for the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And that's that organization responsible for the electric delivery to all of rural America, which is about 56% of the landmass. We looked at this problem, and it's the same problem we had in the 30s. People were in the 30s, you look at the demographics where people were fleeing from the rural areas to the cities. And that was because the cities had electricity and rural America did not. So we connected every home and business with electric wire, and we can do the same thing with fiber optic cable. And I will tell you, you're not going to get development if you're not connected. Today, economic development is roads, water, sewer, electricity, and fiber connectivity. It's got to be fiber as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the environmental side of things, and specifically from your position as an energy CEO, an electric utility. You know, this is something that you've thought a lot about, but I'm curious how you would balance the increasing demand for renewable energy, solar and wind, with Vermont communities who say this is not happening the way we would like it to for our own community. You and I just talked about local control, communities having some say in what happens to them. And on energy issues, several Vermont communities feel like there are very large solar installations that are happening that are sort of outside of the normal zoning practices, and they're not pleased with it. So how would you balance those competing needs?
Well, I do believe in I was the face of the Kingdom Community Wind Project. I learned a very valuable lesson in that, and it really does. You do have to involve the communities and not just the direct community. For example, wind, it's all the communities in the viewshed. I participated and I'm a big cheerleader of a plan called Solar Pathways that was done with the Vermont Energy Investment Corporation with a grant from the Department of Energy over the past couple of years. That lays out the plan. That's the plan that I'm so proud of. And I didn't do the work. I was more the cheerleader. I was at the meetings, but certainly I credit other folks with doing the great work. But that is the best plan I've seen in the country, and it describes how to get to 90% by 2050 of all of our energy sources. So I would make that the comprehensive energy plan and request that the legislature make that the law of the land. Because we export $2 billion a year to fossil fuel companies. And so there's tremendous growth opportunities by growing that plan and the innovation opportunities. And I say all that because that plan does require solar and wind. You think about it, if you're going to be doing renewables, it's got to be solar and wind and plenty of hydro as well. But it shows growth in wind, for example, as well as growth in solar. Now, that wind doesn't need to come from Vermont. And I certainly do question the tearing up the ridge lines when wind turbines in the Midwest produce about twice as much energy over a yearly period. So it doesn't need to come from Vermont. But at the same time, we do have to grow it. But I do believe in a lot more community involvement with those decisions.
So who gets to make the ultimate decision then if a community says, we don't want that farm field to have a big solar installation?
I think the communities need to make the decision because it really becomes the question for Vermont is, we have a plan. We know how to get there. If we don't do it, we won't get there. It is pretty straightforward and simple. But at the same time, it is the decision of the communities.
We got a question from Rebecca, who says, Ms. Hallquist has said she voted for Governor Scott in 2016. Can she explain why, as a Democrat, she voted for Scott instead of, for instance, Sue Minter?
Well, like many Vermonters, I knew Phil Scott. And what I'm looking at today is either the Phil Scott that we didn't know, or if you look at the history of Phil Scott, he didn't really have many challenging decisions. I certainly can regret that decision now.
Do you?
Yes, I do, of course, because of this politics of division. I'm so sad about it. That's why I'm running for governor. I mean, I'm doing my penance. You know, this is not the way I want to see Vermont headed. I was in a comfortable place. We had Obama was in office. You know, November 8th, 9th was totally different than November 8th. And to tell you the truth, I still had some hope. You know, there's still some hopeful signs from the governor. He signed onto the Paris Climate Accord, and then it didn't do anything. So, you know, it took a while for me to realize what maybe many other Vermont Democrats had known already. But I apologize for not knowing that. But like I say, that's why I'm here to fix that.
Do you think Democrats in Vermont are going to reward Phil Scott if they supported his move on gun control in a way that could harm your candidacy in a year that it might otherwise not? In other words, he called for and then signed gun legislation, and this has not happened in the state despite repeated calls from some lawmakers and from some Vermonters. And you could see some Democrats crossing over to vote to say, we appreciate what you did there, and that could certainly pull from your campaign if you're the nominee.
Well, I've talked to thousands of Vermonters, and yes, I do want to acknowledge and recognize for Phil for signing that bill. But at the same time, he hasn't made the investments in mental health funding, you know, and made the appropriate investments to correct the problem. So yes, of course, we want to acknowledge that he signed that bill. But I don't see a lot of Vermonters getting very excited about voting for Phil because of that by itself.
Another listener question here from Julie, who says, with her background in energy, where does Hallquist stand on legislation like Bill H-746, which calls for a ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure in the state? It does allow for maintenance of existing infrastructure.
Well, I that gets to the debate we have to have as a public policy debate. Of course, we have a plan to get 90% by 2050. Those are kind of skirmishes when the real goal is to get 90% to 2050. And we have that plan. Now the questions you asked earlier, that's part of the aggressive public policy discussion I would have as governor. I would institute that as the comprehensive energy plan and talk about the policies to get there. There may be other policies that are even better than that one, which is, you know, for example, I recognize that a price on carbon is as one of the most effective public policies that exist in order to reduce carbon. But we have to be careful how we implement those, because I'm going to tell you, when as CEO, we served 18 of the 25 poorest communities. And I'm going to challenge that we can't solve climate change without addressing economic justice issues. So if we put something in place that costs more money for those people who are living on the economic margin, and there are a lot of those in Vermont, then I can't support it. I've got to support – it's got to be both. It's got to be something that says – because if you look at price on carbon, for example, the question we have to ask is, well, you know, someone who's renting, they can't go out and buy a new furnace. So if all we do is increase their costs and these people are struggling already, you can't – I wouldn't accept that. We've got to figure out how to do – and we can figure out how to do it better. Again, we've laid it out.
Well, does that include your call for a $15 minimum wage in the state?
Oh, absolutely. You know, so this gets to the real heart of our issues. If we had adjusted the wage for inflation since the late 60s, it'd be $22 an hour right now. And oh, by the way, in the late 60s, most people had health care. $22 an hour works out to about $44,000 a year. Then throw another $12,000 for health care. Actually, minimum wage was probably over $50,000. So because we've seen a systematic attack on the middle class, starting with Ronald Reagan and the attack on the unions. The unions and the middle class, I believe, go hand in hand. Strong unions, strong middle class. So because that – you know, the middle and lower income folks haven't seen a raise in 30 years. What we now have to subsidize housing and do other things because and when I talk about economic development, we're going to measure the bottom 20% on the economic ladder and measure that as our success point. So yes, the economic issues are a key core part of everything I talk about.
So $15 minimum wage, would you then lower corporate taxes, lower other taxes to try to get that balance right?
No. I think we've got the other thing about – I have a vision on how to grow Vermont's rural economy. A healthy economy replaces lower wage jobs with higher wage jobs. We absolutely have to change the demographics of Vermont. You know, I want to challenge folks. Just because we've seen this as the demographics is not how it needs to be. We can change that through proper infrastructure investments. We have to focus on the infrastructure first in order to grow Vermont. But we don't need to accept the fact that we're seeing a demographic shift. We've seen it before, and we've corrected it. We can fix it again.
We're talking with Christine Hallquist today. She's a candidate for governor and hoping to be the Democratic nominee after the August primary. Jean writes in to say, I just heard Christine say she supports unions. What's her position on the nurses' strike at UVM Medical Center? And as of our live show here at noon, that's scheduled to start a two-day strike tomorrow.
I will be walking with them first thing tomorrow morning. I support the nurses in their demands in order to get additional staffing as well as pay corrections. I mean, I think this is the same trend we've seen going all across the nation, and I do think that unions are the way to change that trend.
You know, it's interesting. As a candidate, perhaps it's easier to stake a claim and say I'm on this side or I'm on that side. If you were governor right now, would you also be walking?
I would.
So how do you then, you know, create that morale? Say, you know, we're bringing everybody together. I've got to bring the CEOs in. I've got to bring the rank and file in. You know, how do you balance that need to sort of be a leader with somebody who says, look, I'm taking a very strong position on this?
Well, because I have tremendous experience with unions, and I will give you another example. I was on the Hyde Park School Board, and there were five of us on the board were big education supporters, and we got thrown off through a tax revolt. The very following year, the teachers went on strike, and my family walked with the teachers. Unions are a very healthy part of our economy. When there's failures in this kind of thing, it starts with the leader. And, you know, I have a very strong history of leadership, excellent leadership, and there's no excuse for things getting to this point. So I am going to hold the leaders accountable.
Margaret Crowley is chairperson of the Vermont State Employees Association, which is a union that represents state employees, and she's on the line with us. Margaret, what's your question?
Hi, Jane and Christine. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding retirement security as a huge issue for Vermonters. Will you, Christine, pledge to fully support existing defined benefit retirement plans?
Yes. This is also another thing that's happened since the early 80s. We've got to reverse this trend we've got the hugest transfer of wealth in history. And you know, we're not going to fix it overnight. But the decline of the defined benefit plan is part of that issue. And I will tell you, you know, this is where I will again challenge Phil Scott, who claims he's a good business person. You know, holy cow. The one thing you don't do is risk your pension plan. You've got to fully fund the pension plan, because the pension plan depends on the stock market, and the stock market can run wildly. So the governor's putting us at great risk by not fully funding that pension plan.
Let's talk for a minute, too, about healthcare, because certainly when we start talking about things that are costing the state money, things that are costing Vermonters money, healthcare is really prime among them. Do you support a single-payer healthcare system?
I support moving to improve Medicare for all, and I'll tell you why. A couple reasons. First of all, let's start with the big numbers. The United States spends 18 cents of every dollar on healthcare, and European countries spend 8 and 9 cents. And we know it can be done better, much better. And in Vermont right now, our average administrative cost for healthcare is somewhere around 30%. Medicare does it for 5%. So I would challenge everybody. It's not just the leader's job. I want every Vermonter and everybody in this country to demand that we fix this healthcare crisis through moving to improve Medicare for all. We cannot take no for an answer, and I certainly won't take no for an answer. Now, I will also tell you, Vermont got in trouble trying to do this on its own. I mean, it's a pretty expensive bill. If we did it on our own, it's $4.3 billion. But I would organize with other states. There are many states who want to accomplish this goal. We will do it together. And some of those states are pretty big ones. For example, California is, you know, 1/6 the global economy. So we've got we just know that the solutions aren't going to come from Washington. So I would very actively form a union of states. We've done that in other areas to move towards a improved Medicare for all, as well as to fight some of these other things that are coming out of Washington that are quite selfish.
Like what?
Like the immigration issue. You know, I think immigrants can play a great role in Vermont. I will tell you, my sister lives in Syracuse, and I've watched Syracuse over the years. About 15 years ago, Syracuse had an incredible renaissance, and they did that because They started actively recruiting immigrants to Syracuse. You know, I talk to employers, and they're trying to get employees. And, of course, immigrants will also help us with our diversity challenges as well.
Well, to that note, Diana says, what can Vermont do to attract and retain more and younger workers?
Well, we have to get connectivity. It isn't happening if we don't get fiber to every home and business. I'll give you an example. I was at a house party several weeks ago, and they were every single person there was under 30. They were software developers. They were living in Colchester. They'd love to live in rural Vermont, but they can't because you don't get connected. So we absolutely have to get connected. This is kind of like talking about electricity. Think about it in the 30s. If you didn't have electricity, who's going to come and build a business? You know, so I want people to remember this is a critical element of our business, no matter where you are. And our copper infrastructure will never get us there.
I was listening back this morning to an episode of the No Makeup podcast, which you were a guest on. I think it's a year or two now. And you talked in that podcast with Tiff Bloomley about some of the changes that you have experienced, first living as a man and now living as a woman, in terms of gender bias that you just didn't see or perhaps didn't acknowledge, and you know, I don't know whether didn't believe people who might have been telling you, but now from your lived experience, you have actually experienced gender bias in a different way. And I'm curious how that shapes your policy ideas as a gubernatorial candidate.
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. And I'm saying it's an important question because it's one thing to know of implicit bias. It's another thing to experience it personally. And I'll just cite an example. About a week after I transitioned, a stranger on the street said, "Smile, sweetie." Now, in my whole history of being a man, I never had anybody say that to me. So I have a long list of things, and it's built into our language and our culture. You know, I knew these issues. It wasn't like I was ignorant. But it really gets down to how marginalized communities experience the rest of the world. We have a dominant culture, and we all what I hope to do is for people to really be sensitized to the fact that we all have these biases that are built into us. And we have to work hard, and we have to put systems in place to ensure, for example, measure who gets the discipline, measure who gets pulled over, measure and put in oversight to correct those things. But I should also point out, I've only been a woman for 3 years. So it just blows my mind what I've learned in 3 years. It definitely has framed the way I look at things. And I'm very sensitive. You know, you hear me talk about economic justice. I mean, those things are now lived experiences rather than known experiences.
So there are there specific policies that you have sort of come around to a different way of thinking on, and you know, not to put words in your mouth, but something like paid family leave or paid sick leave, which is in many cases for some families seen as a social justice issue, seen as one that where one gender over the other typically bears the burden. Are those things that you have changed your positions on, or maybe just become more strong?
No, I've become more strong. I've always been a supporter of paid family leave. I actually was a supporter in the early 90s when I was on the Associate Industries Board. I was a supporter of single payer health care at the time. So these things are consistent, but it's really about the passion which we're committing to those things. So I'm definitely more passionate about those things. And I also recognize the importance of putting in processes. You know, for example, I would have regular reporting and oversight boards to look at how we target our discipline. And so we have to take an active role to change things. And I will talk specifically when it comes to – I'm going to tell you an interesting thing that I'm very passionate about is we have industries which are dominated by gender. And my industry, the electric utility industry, if you look at our Form 990 reporting, 16 of the 20 highest paid people are line workers. We have line workers with overtime that make well over $100,000 a year. There's not a single female line worker in the state. And if you look in the country, even Duke Energy just has a handful. So we have to fight for equal pay and parity, and we should measure that. But at the same time, we've got to change the way we look at gender in the workplace. You know, if you look at traditional, I like to use the example of the secretary. In the early night before 1900, the secretary was a man. It was paid more. But then when it became a woman, it was paid less.
You and I ran into each other at the Bristol Parade recently, the Bristol 4th of July Parade. I said hello to you. And I was wondering afterwards, you know, when you're an energy CEO, you don't have to walk in parades. When you're a politician, you go to communities that are not yours and you walk in parades and you shake hands with people and you try to introduce yourself to the state. But that also puts you out in public in a way that is perhaps a little bit unfamiliar and perhaps a little bit vulnerable, because certainly politicians get their fair share of people who do not like them. And there's still transphobia in the world and in Vermont. And I'm curious how that experience has gone for you.
Oh, you should know this is not the biggest challenge I've faced running for governor. And I spent 5 years preparing for my transition. In 2010, I started meeting with a transgender counselor, and she asked me, she said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I'm a strong leader as a man. I need to be equally strong as a woman." We spent 5 years preparing for this. I'm totally proud. I'm a proud and out transgender leader. But I should also tell you, that's all it needs to be. You know, people call themselves woman. They call themselves men. I'm a transgender woman. And I know it's different for folks. But, you know, if you haven't met somebody from Syria, they're different too. So I just, you know, I know there are people I've seen, you know, of course, I've seen tremendous number of, you know, the last thing you want to do is go on social media and see some of the things that are said. But I see them, but they don't bother me at all. It's just not an issue.
Does it happen in person?
You know what? Rarely has happened. I can only think of two times when it's happened. No, I guess a lot more. I should tell you, you know, because I tune them out. So the parades, yes, I definitely hear things on the parades. People say, you know, people say, "I'm not voting for that." You know, but it's like, who cares? They weren't going to vote for me anyway.
What do you think, aside from the issues we've already discussed, and there are many that we just haven't had time for, are the most important issues or the most important issue facing Vermont that you think isn't getting enough attention?
I think economic growth and economic development is you know, they're all coupled. When I talk about the four issues that are on my platform, economic development, moving towards improved Medicare for all, accelerating the work we're doing on climate change, and ensuring every child receives a high-quality public education. Those are all intertwined. But certainly, we've got to get more food on the table when it comes to economic development, because right now we're fighting over scraps.
So is that not enough attention, or just the focus is in the wrong place?
It hasn't got the attention and commitment that it needs. It needs leadership. It needs strong leadership from the governor. Again, you know, I know that from a connectivity standpoint, but I also know it when I went up to visit St. Albans. One of the things you'll hear from Dominic, who's the town manager, and Liz, is they were successful because strong involvement from the governor.
That's Christine Hallquist running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Welcome.
You'll find our other interviews with candidates in contested federal and statewide primaries at vpr.net. You can search by the term campaign 2018.